Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I talk to Raphael Baer and George Eaton about the North, Thatcher and Boris. Stuart McConey tells us how to write about the North. Ian Steadman and I chat about the inexorable rise of Bitcoin, and Philip Maughan reads a poem by Simon Armitage. I'm joined by our political editor, Raphael Baer, and George Eaton, editor of The Staggers, to talk a little bit about, well, this idea of two nations, really, George. So explain the idea behind what we've written in the issue this week.
The North-South divide is something that politicians have worried about for centuries, really. But it has got worse recently. At the start of the recession, a lot of people actually assumed that the gap would narrow because it was London, which had an economy so reliant on finance and property, which was where the crash hit. What you've actually seen now is it widening again. So unemployment in most of the major northern regions is still above 10%, while it's fallen dramatically in the south.
There's some fairly startling figures, aren't there? So you've written that while unemployment has fallen to just 5.9% in the southeast, it's risen to 10.2% in the northeast and 8.9% in Yorkshire and the Humber. 96% of all employment growth in England in the past year has taken place in London, the south east, south west and east of the country.
Is that because of reliance on public sector, disproportionate amount of public sector employment, and therefore obviously cuts are going to have an impact on that, which would also suggest that, well, the Conservatives are very keen to argue that actually their austerity programme has worked to the extent that job creation has happened faster than certainly a lot of pessimists on the Labour side and the left would argue. The idea that just clearing away what Tories would see as excess, but public sector jobs doesn't allow a spontaneous mushrooming of private sector jobs if jobs haven't been created in those areas that were most reliant on the state for employment.
Yeah, absolutely. The North has been hit harder by austerity. But another point which quite a lot of Northerners make is there is a lack of investment here as well. The sort of chunk of infrastructure and transport investment that goes to London compared to the North is remarkable. And I think this is in part due to its political weakness. So you have Boris, he's a cheerleader for London. You have Alex Salmond, he's a cheerleader for Scotland. They attract investment.
You've got John Prescott.
Well, isn't this Tim Montgomery's column in the Times this morning is about this idea of an English Parliament, which would be in, I think he suggests, Manchester as one of the places. But there is a big problem, isn't there? That you're right, that there is, it's kind of a region that doesn't have anybody particularly speaking for it. And I can't think how many, I mean, you interviewed Raph this week, Patrick McLaughlin, who is not even that northern.
No, he's a Midlander. He describes himself as a Midlander. But he makes this point, actually, in defence of HS2, the high-speed rail link, that no one really complains when tens of billions of rail investment go to London. But suddenly you try and put it up, across the Midlands, and as he would see it, trying to bring the north and south closer together and giving the north its fair share of investment. And suddenly you have Conservatives up in arms about rail lines kind of slicing through their beautiful shire backyards, and Labour, as Patrick McLaughlin calls it, playing silly buggers about whether or not this is money that should be spent. I mean, I personally found his argument quite compelling, actually, to say, well, at some stage, maybe some of this, if there is money to be spent, then shoveling that bounty up north is probably good politics as well as good economics.
Do you think that an English Parliament is the answer?
Well, the reason I made the joke about John Prescott a second ago is they did talk about having an assembly,
regional assembly.
There was even a referendum for assembly for the Northeast, and it just failed catastrophically. I think the problem you have is that you need a coincidence of authentic identity and political institutions. So it works having devolution in Scotland. It works having an assembly in Wales. It works having a London mayor, because London has a very strong intrinsic identity. Obviously, the regions of England have identities, but how you express that through political institutions becomes a little bit more complicated. And just heaping on new layers of government to try and sort of channel that, what you'd actually get, oh, I'm going to start sounding like a small state Tory here, which I'm not, but you would end up with just another load of elected officials with tiny mandates, probably returned on with sort of 20% of the vote, because no one turns out for those sorts of elections. Just be a jostling elbows with local councillors, Westminster MPs. I'm not sure it would solve anything, really.
And George, wasn't the great hope at one point that elected mayors would take on some of this?
Yeah, so in fact, the only city which voted in favour was Bristol. So all the major northern cities, Manchester, Leeds, Sheffield, Newcastle, voted against it. And that was a political blow to the Tories, because that was one means they thought of reviving their support in the north. So if you could have sort of northern Borises, basically, people might start to
That's a terrifying idea.
Well, the Tories are looking again.
But this is, that's very interesting. But part of the reason that happened is precisely because a lot of those cities are controlled by Labour. The Labour Council did not want a some other institution, some other politician, and sort of trampling on their turf. And the only way you're going to get turnout in a referendum, that sort of thing, is if the machine on the ground gets out the vote. So what you actually had, I think, was the Labour-controlled councils, the Labour Party in those areas, saying, well, no, we're not sure about this. So they didn't get their activists out. They didn't tell people to vote. And they effectively used their machine politics to stop the creation of alternative institutions that might one day threaten their hegemony.
Good. I think that's the first appearance of the word hegemony on the podcast. Hopefully not the last. And just to slightly broaden it out a bit, you've also written a piece, George, for the magazine that talks about essentially the battleground for the next election being whether or not the Tories can make any headway at all. The statistics were quite shocking. I didn't realise that 40 years ago the Conservatives had a majority on Manchester City Council. And now the party holds just 43 of the 158 parliamentary seats in the three northern regions. Are those people coming back?
No, they're not at the moment, and austerity is making it harder to win them back. So I really looked in, just why is it that the Tories do so bad? I mean, some say it's class, but then rich northerners are less likely to vote Tory than poor southerners. Some say it's their employment status, but private sector workers in the north are less likely to vote Tory than public sector workers in the south. So, what is it? And really, it's the toxicity of the Tory brands that Northerners think are much more likely to think David Cameron's out of touch, and much more likely to think that the Conservatives are the party of the rich. It's not that they're sort of ideologically wedded to socialism, and in fact, they're prepared to support a right-wing party like UKIP, in some of them.
Yeah, I mean, the UKIP's performance, I think, in those areas, in some Labour areas, in the May European elections next year will be very interesting to watch, because they came second in the South Shields by-election. They came second, I think, in Rotherham. And there are clearly people who would respond to a pretty right-wing Conservative platform in some ways, who have that cultural inoculation against voting Tory, who don't have that where it comes to UKIP. And UKIP, and if you look at sort of hard right parties across the rest of Europe, what you see is that first they sort of plucked the low-hanging electoral fruit from weak and discredited Conservative parties, but then they came for the left as well, and they started taking those voters from them. And sort of fast, sort of forward-looking Labour politicians see the potential for UKIP to start doing them real damage in the north.
Well, one of the things, Raph, that I found most interesting about your interview with Patrick McLoughlin is you put to him this problem. So he spoke a lot about how people he worked with in the mines were very culturally and economically conservative, but they wouldn't vote Tory. And then this idea about whether or not the bashing of the trade unions is actually, for a lot of people, they go, well, actually, my trade union was very helpful when I was laid off, or when this happened or that happened. And whether or not the Tory party is too wedded to bashing trade unions when actually they're a popular institution with lots of people.
I'm not so sure they're a popular institution with lots of people. I do think they are in the sort of wider, when people don't look at it through a prism of ideology, they are seen as working class institutions, and people who aren't necessarily bothered about the ins and outs of what happened in a selection process in a particular Labour seat and exactly who Len McCluskey is, when they see the Conservatives gunning very hard for trade union bosses, it just comes across as just a bunch of Tory toffs who ultimately don't either understand or probably don't really like working class people very much. And that, obviously, that's a massive problem for the Tories. I mean, my own view, I think the Conservative Party really missed an opportunity, interestingly, earlier this year when Margaret Thatcher died. And there was a great sort of triumphal parade of hooray for Margaret Thatcher's victory, which was understandable. She was a very important figure for the Conservative Party and the country, for a lot of the country. But that was their opportunity, I think, to say, we celebrate the great woman and her legacy, but we also recognise the need to make amends to some communities for whom this woman was an absolute villain. And I think that could have been possible. And I think a sophisticated Tory response would have sort of said, now is our chance to build bridges again to those people who essentially since Thatcher have never considered voting Tory. And I think they really blew that opportunity by just going for full on kind of triumphal proceeding through Westminster.
And having massive pops at the BBC because they were going to air something that was just happened to people who bought a single about. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, the Tory party has been very insistent about all the things it thinks Ed Miliband should apologise for. Not quite so clear-eyed about all the things that people feel Tories have to apologise for.
And I put this to sort of a very senior Conservative, sort of someone on the modernising wing once, and I said, you know, ultimately what really needs to happen to decontaminate the brand in the North is you probably need a moment where a leader actually goes to a mining community and just says sorry about that. Even if you believe that macroeconomically the sacrifice was necessary and is what needed to be done, until you have that sort of Willy Brandt at the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial moment, sorry, it's like over the top analogy, but you know what I mean, you'll never cut through there, I think. The sort of look of slight alarm and incredulity on the face of this Tory made me realise that I'm not sure they really understand that yet.
Mm. And just quickly to finish, George, last night Boris Johnson made some, I think, a series of deeply peculiar but then also some very newsworthy comments about a whole range of things, ranging from IQ to social mobility to why he believes that inequality is good as a kind of engine of envy and therefore driver of capitalism. Why did he make that speech now?
Well, the reason he made it now is because he is quite clearly positioning himself to return to Parliament in 2015. He is worried because he sees people like Theresa May, maybe Michael Gove, snapping at his heels. His star has dimmed slightly. People are beginning to think, actually, has Boris peaked? And here he is now claiming the mantle of, as we were just saying, the woman that the Conservatives still revere. And in some ways, I actually admired his candour, because rather than hiding behind euphemisms and platitudes like a lot of Tories, sort of David Cameron, do, here he came out and said, look, I think inequality is inevitable and desirable. And you can agree or disagree with me.
I imagine that must be phenomenally popular with the awkward squad of people who hated Tory modernisation, which again has been a theme that we've been discussing in recent weeks. Is that a vision that can ever, Raph, lead the Tories to a majority?
The short answer is no, for the reasons that we were discussing earlier. I think Boris is being quite clever here, actually, because he is a very clever man and a very astute politician. What he understands is at this stage of the cycle, his audience is, you know, what in technical terms you call the selectorate rather than the electorate, the people who are avidly paying attention to who might be the next leader of the Conservative Party and who will be voting in an election to choose the leader of the Conservative Party. I mean, this is what Ed Miliband understood better than David Miliband in the leadership election for the Labour Party. So that first win over your own side to get the blooming job and then worry about reaching out to the rest of the country, whereas David was obsessed with thinking, no, I must say things that could make me electable as Prime Minister. No one cares at that stage. And at this precise moment, what really matters to Boris is locking in the Conservative Party. He can then just say the exact opposite in 3 years' time, and people like us will be going, oh, but this is terribly hypocritical. You said something different 3 years ago. Actually, no one else will have noticed or will really care that much. So I think he's being quite clever here.
That's an extraordinarily bleak view of politics, and I think we'll probably end on that note. Thank you, George and Raph. In this week's magazine, Stuart McConey wrote an essay, How to Write About the North. Here's the beginning of it.
First, don't define your terms. The North is not so much a place as a national myth.
So don't confuse your reader with any specific or detailed references to, say, Merseyside or County Durham. The Northerners won't thank you for it anyway, being petty churls riven with factional differences and impacted grudges. Assume that everyone knows what and where the North is. Don't attempt anything as prosaic or useful as an actual definition. Depending on the kind of piece you're trying to write, you'll probably want to convey something of one of the following. Re-return to Road to Wigan Pier, again revisited. Concerned Liberal goes back up north on any convenient Orwell anniversary to find that they're all still eating chips and dying of pneumonia. It's flat white skinny latte, not flat caps.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Anymore. Wide-eyed, well-meant, did you know they have Wi-Fi and sushi-style travel blog occasioned by Hull winning the City of Culture 2017? The shame of my Dewsbury. Daily Telegraph piece by a Today programme presenter who left in 1968 based on inaccurate rates of teenage pregnancy and an obese family he once saw on the Jeremy Kyle show. Auntie's Folly. Screed of burly concealed contempt and suspicion, usually in the Daily Mail Online, on the BBC relocating to Salford, strap-lined, Bill Turnbull fears for his life every time he parks car, say friends. And let me read you another bit. What about... What could be more northern than crime and violence? This should be reflected in your piece. Remember that different rules apply here, and you must get the terminology right. Shoreditch is edgy, whereas Longsight is dangerous. Bow is real. Whitehaven is run down. Hackney is gritty and bracing. Rotherham is bleak and menacing. Other good words to drop are blighted, desperate, red brick, eyesore, hen party, fake tan, and Greggs. Food and shopping in the north is, as we all know, uniformly dreadful. However, if you're a London-based restaurant critic, is there any other kind, it will behove you occasionally to placate your paper's advertisers by leaving NW1 for the north. Hopefully this will be to somewhere civilised like the Inn at Whitewell or Sharrow Bay. But if, God forbid, it's Carlisle or Leeds, be sure to let any minor discomfiture be reflected in your review. Patronise wearily. Imply that the sushi, Iberico ham, marrowbone granita is probably passable for Cumbria, but it would be a laughingstock in Hampstead. Mock the staff's accents and the chef's pretensions to metropolitan standards. Do include something disparaging about any difficulties you had parking the car or getting a taxi. The tone should be high-handed and sneering, but with a hint of noblesse oblige.
I'm joined by our science and tech blogger Ian Steadman to talk about Bitcoin. Now, Alex Hearn, who some listeners to the podcast might remember as our former senior Bitcoin correspondent, has now defected to The Guardian, where he got a front page story this morning about a guy who chucked out his computer hard drive onto a landfill in Newport, and with it, a key for an amount of Bitcoin that is now worth $6.5 million. Dollars.
It's about $4 million.
So let's go right back to the beginning. Who or what is a Bitcoin?
A Bitcoin is a virtual, what's called a cryptocurrency, which is, it's all based on security protocols and very complicated algorithms. It works in a very simple way. It works by, imagine you have a long string of letters and numbers that represents a coin, as it were, or that's your wallet. You have bitcoins, which are units of currency, and you trade them across a network by sending them back and forward like you would with PayPal or something like that. The way it gets clever is that there's no central authority like a central bank or whatever issuing currency. It's all kind of done peer-to-peer, a bit like BitTorrent, where every single computer that is linked into the Bitcoin network verifies every transaction on the network.
Who runs the Bitcoin network?
No one. We all do together. That's what's so clever about it. Everyone who has Bitcoins is equally in charge of it, as it were. And the more people who have Bitcoin, the safer it gets, because it becomes harder and harder for people to fake transactions. Because if you think about it, you're sending money from one person's computer to another. That transaction is then broadcast to the rest of the network. And the rest of the network receives that and goes, yes, I verified that. And they broadcast it out again, saying that's a verified transaction. Every 10 minutes or so, a new what's called the blockchain, which is the public record of all Bitcoin transactions, gets updated with every new transaction based on whatever the majority of computers in the Bitcoin network says were the valid transactions. Does that make
that
sense?
Sort of makes sense.
Yeah.
Who invented Bitcoin?
A man, well, we don't know. Someone called Satoshi Nakamoto, who everyone assumes is a pseudonym for someone. There's a very large cryptography mailing list, which a few years ago, this white paper, which is about 4 pages long, which laid out the sort of framework for Bitcoin, was published on, sent out to all the cryptography experts around the world, and it kind of detailed how you create Bitcoins, which is you basically solve complex algorithmic problems, and as you do that, you're said to mine Bitcoins, and that's where they come from. But the system that he developed, or some people think it might have been a conglomerate of people, just kind of, they published his paper and disappeared. And then it's become this massive thing. And to this day, no one knows where Satoshi Nakamoto is. Although whoever, still owns the most number of Bitcoins in a wallet. And everyone knows it's there because every Bitcoin record is public. Every Bitcoin transaction is public. So we can see all the different wallets, and we know that the biggest one is there, and it was the one that created the entire system is there. But he can never spend it, because as soon as he spends it, he reveals who he is. So it's all very mysterious.
Mr. Kaiser Soze,
it's like a William Gibson novel. It's ridiculous.
Bitcoin. One thing that strikes me is, surely if you mine Bitcoins by solving algorithmic problems, then couldn't you get a really powerful computer and cause a huge deflation by essentially quantitatively easing Bitcoins?
That is what you should be able to do, but it's very clever in that the problems get harder as it goes along. There's on a logarithmic scale, where I think approximately by 2017, half of all Bitcoins that will ever be created will have been created. And sometime around like 2100, it'll run out. There'll be 21 million Bitcoins in circulation, and that's it. And I think we've already reached the point where you make more money by trading Bitcoins than by mining them. Yeah. There was a really cool thing I read today by a security alert put out by F-Secure, which is a large internet security company. Have you heard of the Internet of Things?
Yeah. So this is like trees that sort of speak to you.
Yeah, it's like everything in your house. Your fridge is going to be connected to the internet and be able to order milk.
My fridge should not attain sentience. Yeah. That would not be a good thing.
But what hackers have realized is that instead of buying computers and mining Bitcoins, what you do is you take over people's computers over the internet with malware and viruses.
So it's like essentially like bot farms.
Yeah,
it's kind
exactly.
of idea that you just have.
You have millions of computers around the world that are doing it for you. There was a programmer at EA had used people who were playing games over EA's social networking multiplayer network, had sort of downloaded malware to their computers, and while they were idling away, was using customers' computers to mine Bitcoins. But
did he get sacked for that?
He did, and EA had to pay out quite a large settlement.
Okay.
F-Secure said that the problem with the Internet of Things is a lot of these things like internet-connected fridges and microwaves aren't going to be virus-protected or have firewalls. So you're starting to see this problem of people hacking people's fridges to mine Bitcoins, which is ridiculous. It's all a bit very strange, especially because Bitcoins really don't have much of a use.
Well, this is what I wanted to come to. So the big news this week is that each Bitcoin, which I imagine like a large gold coin, is now worth $1,000.
Yesterday broke $1,000 for the first time, which considering a year ago it was worth about $8 is pretty remarkable.
But the problem being that it's incredibly difficult to cash in.
Yeah.
Cash out, rather.
There are a few companies. There's a pub in Hackney that accepts Bitcoin if you want to buy a pint. But why would you want to? Because the price is going up so fast that you know, you could buy 2 pints by waiting an extra hour, which is kind of a problem with the price there.
So I remember the late, great Alex Hearn confidently informing me that this was a bubble.
It was a bubble.
Is that still the accepted wisdom?
When he said that, it was a bubble. In April, there was most famously, Bitcoins could be used to buy drugs online because they're sort of anonymous, as long as you don't reveal that you own a specific wallet. Like, every transaction's public, but you don't have to register for a wallet, so as long as you keep yourself anonymous in that way, you can buy stuff illegally over the internet. But when he said that, that was like March, April, which is when the first sort of started to go mainstream, and there was a bubble, undeniably. It jumped from about $8 to $10 to about $200 in the course of 2 weeks or something ridiculous. And then it popped and it all went down. But it's gone back up again, and it's probably going to be another bubble. And it's going to break again. It's going to go down because it's just driven by speculation right now. And it's really strange because as long as it has any practical use whatsoever, like, there's a reason to have Bitcoins because you can spend stuff. Virgin Galactic announced this week they're going to accept Bitcoin for flights to space, which is ridiculous.
Well, they'll just do anything for publicity, not to cast aspersions on Virgin Galactic. But
as long as it has any utility value, it is going to be worth hoarding them for speculative purposes. And the nature of it, because there's no central authority, it's not like a central bank that can print money or change interest rates to try and keep tap on bubbles and stuff like that. It's either going to be worth nothing at all and just completely collapse, or stay around but just wildly fluctuating price like this. I mean, it's breaking 1,000 now. Don't be surprised to see it burst, drop down to about 500 for a few weeks, and go up again to 10,000 or something. I've seen quite reputable people claim that, you know, based on some back of the packet maths, that the eventual price for Bitcoin should be, you know, plus $1 million. Which
I would add at this point that nothing that we're saying in this podcast constitutes investment advice.
Absolutely not. I would not advise anyone to believe that is likely to happen.
So before you rush out and put your life savings in Bitcoin.
That's what some people believe. I am more sceptical than that, but that's what some advocates believe.
Well, I'm sure we'll return to it because it does raise a lot of interesting questions, both about, I mean, it's very, I imagine economists find it phenomenally interesting.
They find it frustrating.
Currency in the wild, but also about the idea about what, as more and more of our lives move online, how you kind of, whether or not, I think I find the peer-to-peer aspect of it very interesting.
Yeah, that seems to be the best thing, control. I think. The fact that, a bit like how, I think the protocol of it is the most interesting thing rather than the Bitcoins itself. The idea, I mean, there are loads of other, like, duplicate coins, like Litecoin, Namecoin, Freecoin, all these people that basically do the same thing, but people setting their own little sort of split of currencies. It really attracts that kind of, like, anti-government mindset, both on the right and left, who want to kind of free themselves from the conventional banking system and from government control fiat currency. And there's this idea of the protocol being a bit like how email revolutionized web communication as a standard sort of format. Then money changing over the internet via Bitcoin or similar type of processes will become a standard thing. And that's going to be interesting.
That is going to be interesting. I think it will probably be a while before the New Statesman accepts Bitcoin. But
yes.
Maybe.
If you want to send me some, please do.
Yeah, do send Bitcoin to the usual address. Thank you very much, Ian.
Emergency, a new poem by Simon Armitage. The four-pump petrol garage finally closed, its defeated owner inhaling his ghost in a disused quarry by coupling the lips of his car exhaust to the roots of his lungs via a garden hose. On the bulldozed forecourt, they threw up a tramshed for decommissioned emergency vehicles, where a skeleton workforce served all manneration of mothballed workhorses for occasional call-outs to sitcoms, period dramas, and film sets. And the actual fire station's up for rent, that chapel-shaped building where they stabled the one engine, spit-buffing and wire-wooling the chrome fenders, tea-cutting the steel coachwork to a red flame. So what you see, as the letting agent puts it, is what you get. Boot cupboard, functional kitchenette, brass hooks, two still holding a brace of yolk-yellow plastic helmets, Northlight roof windows, an inspection pit. The makeshift crew were volunteer part-timers, butchers, outmenders, greasy perchers and hill farmers who'd pitch up in bloody aprons, boiler suits or pyjamas, then venture forth, fire-slaying on the tender. Sometimes in dreams, my firefighting forefathers appear, alien-like, breathing from oxygen cylinders through a sudden parting of towering black cumulonimbus on fully telescoped turntable ladders. The bank's gone as well, and also the post office, though in the store come off license, you can still sign a gyro with a string and sellotape tethered half-chewed biro, or deface a scratch card, or sell a bull mastiff. The horizon ablaze, is it more fire or sundown? In the local tap room, prescription jellies and tinfoil wraps change hands under cover of Loot magazine and Tetley beer mats. What is it we do now?
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, available every week on iTunes and from newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.